Bancroft Prize-winning historian and legal expert Michael Klarman joins us this morning to discuss his account of modern litigation over same-sex marriage. His new book, From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. After looking at the treatment of gays in the decades after World War II and the rebirth of the modern gay rights movement with the Stonewall Rebellion in 1969, Klarman describes the key legal cases involving gay marriage and the dramatic political backlashes they ignited. Klarman also notes several ways in which litigation has accelerated the coming of same-sex marriage, forcing people to discuss the issue, raising the hopes and expectations of gay activists, and making other reforms like civil unions seem more moderate by comparison. In the end, Klarman discusses how gay marriage is likely to evolve in the future, predicts how the U.S. Supreme Court might ultimately resolve the issue, and assesses the costs and benefits of activists pursuing social reforms such as gay marriage through the courts. Harvard Law professor Michael Klarman's new book is From the Closet to the Altar. Michael Klarman, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It is a great pleasure to have you and to discuss the book and the subject. When it came to writing the book, how did you decide where where to begin, where the beginning point would be?
So I come at the project from a somewhat unconventional perspective, which is I'm interested in court decisions in general that have this effect of getting in front of public opinion and generating political resistance. So same-sex marriage litigation is one example of the phenomenon, but Supreme Court decisions on the death penalty, abortion, and school segregation back in the 1950s are other examples. Once I decided to undertake a project specifically on same-sex marriage litigation, I wanted to provide some background so that people got a sense of how dramatic the changes have been in the last 20 years. So the litigation that has had a chance of success really starts with Hawaii in 1993, but if you go back to the 1950s and 1960s, to an era in which even the American Civil Liberties Union didn't think that homosexuals had any protected privacy rights, an era in which police routinely raided gay bars, in which the United States government would not hire people who were openly gay, you get a good sense of how dramatic the changes have been just in the last half century, to the point today where a majority of the country actually supports same-sex marriage. It's just an extraordinary change. 50 years ago, people would have thought that was inconceivable.
So let us start with, you begin the book with the years following World War II. And just to use as an example, where were we then? What were, as you say, the change has been monumental. But on average, as far as policy goes and as far as court decisions go, where were we in the 1950s as a baseline?
Right. So let me think of what some of the most dramatic examples would be that would illustrate the change between then and now. People who belonged to gay rights organizations in the 1950s, and there weren't very many organizations and there weren't very many people who belonged, but they actually wanted to hide their membership because simply identifying yourself as gay would mean that you would probably lose your job, that your family might disown you, and so forth. So the idea of gay rights activism, people publicly participating in organizations that engaged in public protest, was just inconceivable. The American Psychiatric Association regarded homosexuality as a mental illness. All 50 states made it a crime for consenting adults to engage in same-sex practices. The U.S. government would not employ gay people. The U.S. military would not take gay people. An extraordinary set of circumstances to anyone coming at this issue from today's perspective.
When, as you mentioned a moment ago, you talk about the significance of the decision in Hawaii, what led to that and why ultimately was it so groundbreaking?
Right. So there actually had been some litigation after Stonewall in the early 1970s. So in a couple states like Minnesota, Washington, Kentucky, there had been lawsuits in the early 1970s claiming a right to same-sex marriage, but the courts didn't take the argument very seriously. What changed in Hawaii is that the state Supreme Court in 1993 not only took it seriously, but suggested that there would be a presumptive recognition of a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. The court kicked the case back for a trial, giving the state an opportunity to show a compelling reason why same-sex couples should be denied access to marriage. But the general understanding was when the case got back to the Hawaii Supreme Court, it would issue a square ruling in favor of same-sex marriage. This was very early in the litigation campaign. The lawsuit was brought by three same-sex couples in Hawaii. They could not get the support of national gay rights organizations. Gay marriage was not a priority of gay rights organizations before 1990. Even those organizations that might have supported a right to same-sex marriage probably thought there was no chance they would win in court in the early 1990s. And even if they did win in court, they were concerned that it would provoke a massive political backlash. And that's pretty much what happened. I think they miscalculated as to whether they would win. They did win in the Hawaii court. At least they won provisionally. But in response, you got a backlash where 35 states passed laws purporting to defend traditional marriage, and Congress passed the Defense of Marriage Law. So it was a victory well in advance of where public opinion was. And even in Hawaii, it led to a state constitutional amendment that was supported by 70% of the population that banned same-sex marriage.
At what point did things really start? Because again, when you look at this overall, where things really started to speed up and our thoughts on marriage and what was traditional and what was fair going from civil union to same-sex marriage, of how we even got into that conversation and ultimately how we were able to sustain that conversation to get things done so quickly.
Well, you can see opinion changing very gradually in the 1990s. So there's a small increase in the percentage of Americans who support gay marriage. There's a much larger increase in the percentage of Americans who support other forms of equality with regard to sexual orientation, for example, anti-discrimination laws, hate crimes laws. You see a significant increase in support for those sorts of measures in the 1990s, and you see a change in popular culture. So you see popular television programs starting to cover the issue. You see Ellen DeGeneres coming out as a lesbian in her program in 1997 that puts her on the cover of Time magazine. So you're seeing gradual changes. They accelerate in the first decade of the 21st century. So, you know, as late as 2004, opposition in the country to same-sex marriage is still by a margin of about 2-1. But that changes between 2004 and 2010 when you get the first opinion polls that actually show a majority of Americans supporting same-sex marriage. And today it might be a margin of as much as 5 or 10% in favor, and it's still accelerating. So there was a dramatic change just in the last 10 or 12 years, and the change seems to be accelerating. The rate at which people are supporting same-sex marriage is growing dramatically, and you're starting to see that reflected in more legislatures adopting same-sex marriage. And I think in November, you'll see it reflected in a couple of state referenda where the opinion polls suggest gay marriage will win for the first time in popular votes.
When you think of it as a fight for on behalf of those who are looking to get married of the same sex, do you think it always in some way, shape, or form will be a fight? Or in 10, 20, 30 years, we'll look back at this as a period where we took care of the issue?
I think very much the latter. This is an issue where the change is happening so rapidly, and it seems like the change is a one-way ratchet. So if you look at young people, you know, people below the age of 30, they already support gay marriage by something like 70 to 30%. And there's absolutely no reason to think that as they get older, they're somehow going to become less supportive of marriage equality. At the current rate of change, there will be a majority of people in every state in the country in support of same-sex marriage within another 10 or 12 years. And I think within two decades, gay marriage will have largely swept across the country, and people will, as you say, look back and say, we don't even understand what was so controversial. In the same way that today, you look back at school segregation, which in 1954 literally split the country down the middle. There were as many Americans who opposed Brown versus Board of Education as supported it. But 20 years after that, and certainly, you know, today, 58 years after that, people can't even understand what it is that white Southerners were arguing for when they suggested that racial segregation needed to be preserved. I think in the same way, people will look back and have a hard time even understanding what the arguments were against gay marriage. We're not there yet, obviously. The country's still split down the middle, but we're moving so rapidly in one direction, and it's hard to give an account for why that change would suddenly be stymied or reversed. I just don't see that happening.
In a broader context, why must these fights be done step by step? In the sense of, women must fight for the right to vote. It is not a matter of human rights or civil rights that okay, it's women, it's African Americans. And in the same case here, where it isn't a matter of human rights, is that gays and blacks and women should be treated, any minority should be treated as an equal. Why do we not learn that lesson early and allow it to, once we work it out with one group, it would seem that would pave the way very quickly, instead of decades and decades and decades for the next victory to come. And does that just mean that we have to fight for it, that it has to be a fight, and until that fight has been completed, it's not accepted?
I do think you always have to fight for social change. It's a great question. I think the reason why you have to fight for social change is because, maybe twofold. One is, people have a vested interest in preserving the status quo. There are some people who benefit from the way things are. And second is a more kind of ideological explanation, an explanation focused on ideas, which is not simply that people have a vested material interest or stake in the status quo, but people develop mindsets that justify the status quo and are then very resistant to changes. So think about material interests. It's not hard to imagine why whites in the South were resistant to African Americans receiving equality, because it meant, at a minimum, whites were going to lose their monopoly on good jobs. It meant whites were going to have to share political power with African Americans. It meant that whites were going to have to suddenly provide more funding for education, because they had so scandalously been underfunding black education. So there's a material interest. Same thing with gender norms. Men benefited from a system of male supremacy. You know, it was a nice thing for many men to have wives who would serve them. It was a very nice thing not to have women competing for the same jobs. You know, it was a kind of anti-competitive arrangement. You're protected from half of the population competing against you for the best jobs or the best spots in a university. Those are the material explanations, but there's also a kind of ideological framework that develops around the status quo, so that most whites believed in white supremacy. They thought African Americans were created inferior, and they thought that if you had integration, you were ultimately going to have interracial marriage and interracial sex, and that would lead to a dilution of the race. They told themselves stories about how God intended the races to be kept separate. And the same thing with male supremacy, right? We developed powerful ideologies about how men and women were different, how women were created by nature to serve men, and that they didn't have all the same intellectual and leadership capacities. Same thing's true with sexual orientation. A lot of the ideology comes from fundamentalist religion, the idea that God intended marriage to be about men and women procreating. The next generation should be raised by a man and a woman who had procreated within marriage. Those kinds of conventional ideological stories, those kinds of frameworks, have very powerful staying power, and people resist the changes. They find it frightening. It's upsetting. It counters everything that they thought they knew about the world. So I think social change always requires a lot of struggle for those reasons.
When you talk about that struggle and where we are now, And how much has been achieved? Does it have to do with so many of us? Do our public values and our public thoughts on issues change? Because so many, and I'm speaking to you from a Northeast perspective, so I say, you know, so many of us know or have been to a same-sex wedding, know someone who has gotten married, know someone who is in a committed, loving same-sex relationship. And obviously, I mean, to me, that has more sway than anything else.
I think that's exactly right. That's always been the strategy of the gay rights movement since the first large gay rights organizations were formed in the early 1970s. It's the coming out phenomenon, and the idea is as somebody comes out about their sexual orientation and they're open about it, their friends, their family members, their coworkers will now know somebody who is openly gay. And it will be less of an abstract alien concept, and they will now be the public face of the issue. And that's had a powerful effect, right? The social science studies show that the most powerful predictors of progressive views about gay equality come from knowing people who are gay, from having family members who are gay. And that is a one-way ratchet. I mean, that only works in one direction. As more and more people know and love people who are gay, it's going to change their attitudes and make them more accepting of equality. And so many prominent supporters of the gay rights movement get into it as a result of having a child or a friend or a neighbor or a coworker come out as gay, and then so many more people feel invested in the struggle. You know, there's one really powerful illustration of this. I mean, there are many, but one that I think is especially salient for me as a law professor who teaches constitutional law. In 1986, when the court confronted the issue of whether same-sex sodomy could be criminally punished or whether the Constitution protected a right of adults to choose their sex partners, Justice Lewis Powell, who was the swing vote, was discussing the case with a law clerk who, it turned out, unbeknownst to Justice Powell, was gay. And Justice Powell said to the law clerk, "I've never known a gay person in my life." And 25 years later, you just can't imagine a Supreme Court justice or any judge making a statement like that, because, as you point out, it seems like virtually everybody today knows people who are gay, and that affects the way they think about the issue. So if Justice Powell had known that his law clerk, who was gay, and he didn't know it, if he'd known it, he probably would have thought differently about the issue, because he has a lot of respect and admiration for his law clerk. And that effect just gets multiplied over and over again through millions of individual interactions. And that's the largest explanation for why we've made so much progress in the last few decades.
In looking at gay rights overall, obviously same-sex marriage is but just one issue. So is that the domino that helps in the others?
Well, in some ways, you know, many of the others have been the dominoes that helped with gay marriage. So, you know, today there's a constitutional right for same-sex couples to engage in private consensual sex, as compared with 50 years ago when every state criminalized that. But what happened is most states started to repeal the criminalization, and finally the Supreme Court decided there was a constitutional right. Congress, you know, passed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and then repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell. As many as 20 or 30 states have laws now providing hate crime protection based on sexual orientation. 20 states or so have public accommodation laws protecting against discrimination based on sexual orientation. But there are still some dominoes left to fall. So after gay marriage is, well, I think what the next domino will be the repeal or the judicial invalidation of the Defense of Marriage Act. I think that's going to go pretty soon. Then you'll start to see more states enacting gay marriage, and eventually I would predict a Supreme Court decision saying there's a constitutional right. But another big component of the gay rights agenda has been a federal law forbidding employment discrimination with regard to sexual orientation, and that has not yet been secured, and that's something that gay rights groups have been pushing for really more than two decades. So I think that would be another important achievement for the gay rights movement. That, I think, may come after gay marriage, although I'm not sure about that.
As we wrap up and you look at the presidential contest, so much was, you know, we talked about how, look, it's going to be the economy, it's going to be jobs, and those are certainly major issues in this campaign. But when it comes to the campaigning and when it comes to solidifying the base, abortion, gay rights, those issues are very much in the forefront, very much in the spotlight. And I asked the question that I asked from the very beginning, which is, will they always be?
Well, I don't think they always will be, but you're right, they still are now. And in 2004, there is a decent argument that the presidential election ended up turning on gay marriage because President Bush would not have been reelected had he not won Ohio, and he won Ohio by 2 percentage points, and there was a gay marriage ban on the ballot that year in Ohio, and it passed by 24 percentage points. So if you think that more people might have turned out to vote because of the gay marriage ban, they wanted a chance to vote for it, or if you think some Democrats, people who are leaning Democrat, might have voted Republican because they preferred George Bush's view on gay marriage to John Kerry's, it might very well have influenced the election outcome in 2004. As you say, in 2012, most people are voting on the economy, but it is totally conceivable that the election comes down to a few thousand votes in Ohio again, and Governor Romney and President Obama have diametrically opposing views on gay marriage. It's not inconceivable that there are tens of thousands of voters out there who still think gay marriage is an issue that's bringing them out to the polls or influencing who they vote for. So I don't think it's likely that the election will turn on gay marriage, but it's not inconceivable that it will. It happened once before, and it's still an issue, and it still divides people, and the two presidential candidates have diametrically opposing views on it.
Michael Klarman's new book is From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. Michael Klarman, thank you very much for spending time with us and sharing your expertise. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, From the Closet to the Altar, it is published by Oxford.